Perhaps we could begin with some of the presenters asking questions to one another, and then opening up to the floor here.
I would very much like to ask a question. I think probably directed especially to Daryl, but Father Crossan may want to comment as well. In your outline, Daryl, and I think this is a fair summary of something you said in your talk, amoral selfishness necessarily is inherent in all living beings, but sets the stage for immoral behavior on the part of moral agents once they evolve. What I'd like to ask is this. To what extent would genuine morality, getting beyond this inherent selfishness, require some sort of religious grounding within our own tradition, something like the Bible's teaching, love your neighbor as yourself, Jesus' teaching, love one another as I have loved you, or whoever would save his life will lose it, whatever loses it for my sake will save it. Apart from that, what, if anything, would you say prevents this original selfishness becoming simply the foundation of moral teaching for human beings like Nietzsche's will to power? And a related question, if I may ask it, you also say that most altruism in animals is explicable by kin selection or reciprocal altruism. But would you be willing at all to say that you could speak of some aspects of truly moral behavior in creatures other than human beings? And I'll give you an example of what I mean, even though they're rare. Occasionally, we read in the paper of something like a lioness adopting a baby zebra and protecting it, or a she-wolf taking care of a lamb. There doesn't seem to be anything like kin selection or reciprocal altruism at work there. Is there any way at all in which you might call such behavior genuinely moral?
Yeah, this is a point that Franz de Waal stresses in a lot of his work, the primatologist down at Emory, that, you know, obviously we can talk about selfishness being present in life all the way from the bottom up. But he wants to say, yeah, just as you can find, you can easily find in animal behavior the roots of human misbehavior, you can also find in animal behavior the roots of human moral behavior. That it's not all ugly when you look at the animal world. There's which is to be expected from an evolutionary perspective, because in evolution, stuff doesn't come out of nowhere. Things gradually come to be. They gradually emerge, and so you need to look at the rudimentary beginnings of things, and that would include morality. And de Waal, in his books, makes a strong case for this. So, yeah, you can find the beginnings of, well, we talk about altruism, and there's a lot of debate over whether altruism is present in other species, or debate whether it's present in our species. But things have to start somewhere, and if you look for the beginnings of altruism, you need to look, first of all, at reciprocal altruism, for example, where it is just self-interested, but then you can visualize and even maybe observe in nature how you get from that basic self-interest to something that is a little less self-interested. And with the asymptote, I suppose you'd say, being the kind of perfect altruism that we see in the teaching and example of Jesus, for example. The idea of doing good for others where there's no pay back to you. You are being completely self-sacrificing and so forth, which is what we as Christians are called to approach as closely as we can. But of course, we never perfectly get there, which is why I say it's asymptotic. But along the way, yeah, you can find degrees of that. Well, you're never quite sure what degree you're really looking at, because our in this intermediate evolutionary state that we are all in, our motives are always very mixed. We can't even always tell by introspection, you know, how selfless am I really being? Maybe not as selfless as I would like to think I am, or like others to think I am. So, and if you look at other species, yeah, I mean, why does one animal take care of an unrelated animal? Is it because a maternal instinct is being triggered, or is there something more conscious to it than that? We don't know, but we would expect to see a wide gray area in evolution and individual development, for that matter. But yes, certainly I would say that you can find examples in other species that are worth talking about, worth looking at. Now, the earlier part of your question now was
to what extent you need a religious grounding to get beyond this inherent selfishness.
Well, certainly there are plenty of moral atheists around. To what extent is modern atheism a derived as opposed to a primitive state? I suspect most atheism is developed as a rejection of one or another religious tradition these days. I mean, I don't think there are very many atheists around who were never exposed to any sort of religion. I don't know to what extent in prehistoric humans there was ever an atheistic attitude. There were, in all the primitive societies we know of, there seems to be some level of spirituality, religious consciousness developed. But certainly in antiquity you find philosophers who are not adherents of any of the modern religions, Marcus Aurelius, there's some folks like that, the Stoics, who come up with very sophisticated moral codes, I think you'd have to say, that are based on reason. And you have many people today who would say you can base a moral code on reason. You can even base a moral code on evolutionary principles. You have people like Julian Huxley who did that. At just at the same time, you get people who started with evolutionary theory and came up with some very obnoxious sorts of codes for action, the Nazis and other folks who started with similar presuppositions and went in the opposite direction. So, yeah, you can certainly do a lot in developing morality just based on the logic of interpersonal relationships, and this is what Duval talks about in the animals, really, that there are good adaptive reasons for treating your neighbors well, so that they'll treat you well, and you will live in a peaceful society. And in ape societies, for example, it's been demonstrated that the members of that society actively enforce their ethics, their rules of behavior, to have the kind of group dynamics they are comfortable with. If somebody is disruptive, they punish that member and enforce some basic rules of behavior, which are basically the same ones we would want to enforce. You know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, etc., etc. And the golden rule, do unto others, that's at best the starting point of human ethics. That's something that lots of other species of animals use the golden rule. That's reciprocal altruism. It's not a high moral standard. I have a question for Father Crossan.
Sure.
You said about the varieties of understandings of natural law.
Yeah.
And one you came down on, sort of a general one, that it had to do with rational reflection.
Yeah.
About.
Yeah, because that's a very clear, as opposed to some of the others are more complicated.
Now, I'm wondering to what extent that can get away with being armchair rational reflection. And among all the varieties of natural law philosophies that you're aware of, how many of them explicitly acknowledge the need to study nature in order to come up with an idea about natural law? Study nature in the way that scientists would study nature, to have their understanding of natural law informed by the nature, by whether it's human nature or broader than that. How much does that need to enter into it in the view of different natural law thinkers?
Well, for the folks that my mentor, Dr. May, is in league with as part of their school, and when they started it, their work, they referred to social psychology. We see that these inclinations and goods are pursued throughout the world, and we base that on, social psychological studies. So that piece of it, it has some empirical ground. But generally, Pope and his book, their school is criticized for not dealing with evolution and not having a scientific mindset. The founders are all they're all lay Catholics, and they're all philosophers. And you can see that. So it's them dealing, they say, Immanuel Kant raised good questions to Catholicism, how do we respond? How do we respond this way? So they develop a basically deontological, if you know that terminology, deontological system. But they do things that have some roots in reality. And they do have, Dr. Grisey has a lengthy book on moral cases. This is the case, this is how we solve it based on our system. So it's not floating in mid-air, part of it might be floating in mid-air, but part of it is social scientific, and part of it is practical case-oriented. I think it's missing something, as does, I agree with Pope and his critique, that they could have delved into that more. But again, people go with their expertise, and the expertise probably among their group of thinkers, it's not in evolutionary biology or science and theology debates. So,
I might ask Bob something. Could you speculate on why you think it is that in the development of Darwinian thought, the whole emphasis on mutuality and cooperation was overlooked?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the material mechanical axioms of science. The idea of closure is one of the fundamental axioms of science, that explanations must be in terms of material and mechanical causality. Such ideas as final causality or formal causality are essentially stricken. And it's rather difficult, I believe, to forward a case for mutuality strictly in those terms. And I think that a lot of scientists want to avoid this slippery slope that might lead down to transcendental thinking. That's my personal reason why I think there's a very, well, okay. In my book, I also talk about the very beginnings of the scientific era, where there was a very, we'll have to be honest about this, very rampant clericalism, where clerics, could say, who lived and died, who burned at the stake, and so forth. And if you said the wrong thing, you were in great jeopardy. And the idea was to divorce what you were doing in science as far as possible from the transcendental. And there was, you know, great effort to do that. So you created this great chasm between sort of what was allowed to be discussed, mostly material, mechanical, non-living stuff, and the transcendental. It's such a deep chasm that life just fell right into that chasm. And I think we're now faced with trying to haul life out of that chasm and rehabilitate it as a scientific discipline. But we can't do that, I believe, under the assumptions of closure, atomism, reversibility, determinism, and universality, which are the opinions of normal, I don't want to say Newtonian thinking, because there was a gentleman who corrected me on that, but rather Enlightenment thinking.
Is there much evidence that gives you hope that your line of thought is beginning to take root and become more prevalent?
Well, not amongst those, the keepers of the watch, whom I will call them, those who say what legitimate science is. I think what we're discovering in science right now is that there is in the postmodern world in general, there's a tendency for people to get a little bit away from the metaphysics of science and just talk about the practitioner. And a lot of practitioners are discovering that we can create models that don't strictly follow these absolutes of closure, atomism, determinism, these autonomous agents and models and so forth, so that what's going on, I think, physicists discovered networks, for example. And unfortunately, I think most of what physicists want to do with networks is give material and mechanical explanations for why various network patterns occur. And I don't think they're aware of the broader causality and the broader balance between constraint and flexibility that networks imply. And I think as we go further down this pathway, people will begin to open up to it. So yeah, I am optimistic about it. I'm not sure, and I don't think it'll probably come in my lifetime, but I am somewhat optimistic.
Well, now here's my question to you. Panentheus was an Aristotelian of a sort, like our patron, St. Francis de Sales, who was a synthesizer, but followed Thomas Aquinas a lot, but not exclusively. And so I'm saying, why would it make more sense for you to go to, say, there's the phenomenological Thomism of John Paul II, or there are other schools of thought that broaden out the Thomistic Aristotelian perspective? Why do you find it, maybe this is too much for this session, but why do you find panentheism works better? You find it has more explanatory power? I've always been a little distant from these kind of process views of God. Though people can ground them legitimately, biblically. Anyhow, I just want to raise that question because I tend to want to be an Aristotelian of a type, but an expanded or developed, as did the late Holy Father and other thinkers, Father Clark, I think it was, of the Fordham and so forth.
Okay, well, mainly because evolution is about change. Change in a world divorced from essences, the Platonic essences. And I can't comment on the phenomenology of Husserl or John Paul II and so forth. I can only talk about the phenomenology that I, as an engineer, know, which is a good deal simpler and whatnot. And I'm greatly aware of the fact that when there is a phenomenological observation, and the way an engineer looks at phenomenology is that you can come up with a formula, if possible, a quantitative formula, if not, just You come up with a formula that explains that characterizes the data in abstraction from the cause, what is causing the data. Okay, that's engineering phenomenology. If you can come up with a phenomenological observation and there is a theoretical observation that contradicts it, it is always the theoretical observation that is at risk, not the phenomenological. This was the big clash in the 19th century between Sadie Carnot, who came up with phenomenological quantitative description of the second law of thermodynamics, and there was this big, big problem. Hey, look, all the laws of mechanics are reversible. Okay, so that if we've got these little billiard balls knocking around on each other in a reversible fashion, how in the world are we seeing irreversibility at the macro scale? And this was an issue that really conflicted science for about 50 years during the 19th century. But during that time, it was the atomic theory that was at risk, not the phenomenology. So, given that, here I am looking at an evolutionary world, and for me this is sort of phenomenological. And we have these theories, Platonic or otherwise, about how this might be happening. I feel it's always the contradictory metaphysics that's at risk. So I was searching for a metaphysic that that would be commensurate with an evolutionary view of life. While I'm at that, on that subject of metaphysics, my book is mostly concerned with critiquing what I would call the Enlightenment metaphysic. I mentioned the five cardinal assumptions, closure, atomism, etc., etc. I feel that those were a consensus that was formed in a time just after, the clericalism and so forth, in an attempt to distance oneself from anything numinous. And as a result, it's hard to give full access, acceptance of all of these five without shedding the belief in the numinous. Okay? It's not a neutral metaphysic in my estimation. Others may feel it is, but I think other scientists feel like I do, that it's not a neutral metaphysic. You know, if you're really serious about this, it's hard to believe in God, period. I was searching for a neutral metaphysic, one that most of my friends in science are agnostic or atheistic. I was searching for a metaphysic that we could have a civil conversation over, the idea that they could accept this metaphysic and I could accept this metaphysic, and there was no need for each of us to say anything untoward about each other's mental capacities or whatever. Truly. And the only thing that I could find of such a neutral vein was process philosophy or process assumptions. So that I came up with three assumptions. There's essentially contingency. I used to call it chance, but Billy Grassi, who heads Metanexus, says, I don't like chance. Why don't you invent something else? Okay, contingency. Contingency, there's something truly, truly contingent. And then that's independent from law. Okay, contingency, and then self-influence. Okay, which is essentially feedback on a catalysis, which leads to feedback in auto catalysis, and finally history. And each of those three things contradicts one of the three. For example, self-influence contradicts closure because you always have to look downward. History contradicts determinism. Reversibility, and contingency contradicts determinism. Although this is contradictory of many of the Enlightenment principles, I've tried to argue that they're still commensurate with evolution and biology as we see them today, and that they form a neutral ground where I don't have to give up my beliefs in the numinous, and my counterparts who are atheists don't have to admit that God exists and is as a panentheist active in the world.
Yeah, thank you.
I might have a quick, since I haven't asked any questions, a real quick question of, well, that's not real quick, I guess, but of Darryl, a discussion we had on our back porch down at our home in Gainesville. I feel that the process view of evolution essentially obviates the ontological problem of theodicy. In other words, why is there evil? I think it's no longer a mystery why there is evil, because without evil, there is no progress. But, it, you know, as I said in my talk, what it doesn't alleviate is the problem, the moment of problem, the problem of magnitude. You know, it's not why does evil and suffering exist, it's why does major evil and major social evil and major natural suffering, why do they exist? I think that still remains, and you were of the feeling that no, you felt it didn't. You know, I can think of all sorts of examples of evils, great and small, that accidentally result in good. You know, my favorite examples are Albert Einstein committed what I would call petty transgressions, petty evils, if you will, by working in the patent office. He would take 2 hours to work on patents and then just forget about what he was being paid for and work on relativity theory. Well, if it hadn't been for his little petty evil, we would be denied a major, you know, a major advance in our understanding and so forth. At the other end of the extreme, I had a Japanese friend and colleague and so forth who was born in Hiroshima. And one day he asked me, he said, "Do you know about Hiroshima?" "Yes, I know about Hiroshima." And so, you know, feeling a little uncomfortable, I said to him, "Well, tell me, how do you feel about Hiroshima? Was it a great evil?" And he says, "Well, I can't say that." Of course, he's thinking, I think, more from a Buddhist point of view, but in a very practical way, right after the explosion, his father was badly burned and taken to a hospital, and he was looked after by this nurse who became his wife, who then became his mother and father. So here you have a major, major fount of suffering, which gives rise to a small good. These are some of the two extremes. But anyway, my question to you would be, you really feel that my normative calls are unnecessary. Would you care to elaborate?
Sure, I think the problem is, where do you draw the line between big evil and small evil? It's a continuum, like everything else in this business. Another question is, if the question is, why doesn't God at least prevent the greatest evils? Well, how do we know he doesn't? I mean, how do you know the evils that we know of are the worst possible evils? Okay, you talk about Hiroshima. Okay, but there has not been a global thermonuclear war. The weapons haven't been used since Hiroshima, and maybe they would have been if they had not been initially used on a scale of 2 cities. Maybe if the war had ended before they were used or without their being used, and then the Soviet Union and the U.S. both had bigger weapons than that going into the 50s and 60s, somebody might have pushed the button just to see what would happen, and we could have been in a much worse situation. And if the worst, even the worst evils that we know of were prevented by divine intervention at the last minute, then the remaining ones would be the worst ones we know, and wouldn't we complain about why the worst evils are not permitted? You know, if the worst evil you knew of was a stubbed toe, wouldn't you scream to heaven when you stub your toe? It's a continuum that we can't easily deal with. But I think the more serious reply might be that it's all a part of autonomy of the creation. Now, at what point is God going to pull our chestnuts out of the fire? Well, maybe not at any point. You know, if there are millions of inhabited planets in the universe, how many of them statistically would be expected to exterminate themselves one way or another? And would that hopefully small percentage be rescued at the last minute by God? I do not think so. I think that if we are crazy enough to do something suicidal, I think we're going to end up dead. And I don't think we can depend on God to rescue us from our folly at the last moment, because the rules that God seems to be playing by are to let us deal with the consequences of our own choices. And I think having become the father of a teenager, I think nothing else could give one an equally good insight into the mind of God. Because, not because I have acquired divine wisdom from it, but because seeing the problems that one confronts, even in a relatively unproblematic situation, when you're raising someone who is approaching or even attaining adulthood, as a parent, you still want to, you know, rescue them from their mistakes, but you know that beyond a certain age or point of development, they're not going to listen, you know, or they might listen and then go do their own thing anyway. And what can you do? You know, use force or just be there as much as you can to support them, to be there if they, to some extent, if they need you to some extent. And I think that's pretty much the situation God is in, if he's going to respect us as autonomous partners in relationship, which was, I think, the whole point of creating this world to begin with, to have partners in relationship. You can't be a micromanager of your partner in relationship. That person has to make his or her own mistakes, and you hope for the best, and you keep your hands off, because you know, if you try to force the issue, if God tries to force the issue, that sort of negates the whole point of the exercise.
I just add to that it's autonomy, but at the essence is love. There is no love without autonomy,
right.
And that's the bottom line, love.
Can we ask the audience
also
if they wish to ask any questions?
Abbot James Wiseman, you said you didn't believe in the pre-existence of the soul. And if you touched on this, I missed it. How did you intellectually rule it out? And if you did, how did you rule out the pre-existence of the soul?
How did I come to that conclusion? Is that your question?
Yes.
That there...
Yes. Did you have a way of ruling?
Did you have a way that you were able to rule it out, that there could be a pre-existing soul?
I think my answer was simply based on my assumption that a totally separate soul is to me literally incredible. That the soul is an aspect of my being once I am in existence, and that means before my conception, there was in no respect a James Wiseman.
Thank you. I have a question. This has bothered me for some time, and that is, I think it's mostly for Father Crossan, but moral values and teaching and ethics lead to good. That's the intention.
Right.
A path to good. Now, the church teaches that contraception is wrong. However, if we don't control population, the earth becomes overpopulated and God's creation is destroyed. Now, there seems to be a conflict there between what, on one hand, may look like a moral good in the short term, and the long-term natural consequences, which would lead to natural evil, potential fighting for resources, which would be very human and evolutionary. He has some comments on that.
Okay, we'll change seats here. Well, I'll offer a few comments. It's just like this presentation, you know, 45 minutes, you can't give a full bar of theology, but the implication that you can at least hit some points. So I hit some points. One is, of course, the data is that we're about to start on the way down with the population. That's at least the data I've read in popular publications that said, and in Europe and Russia, that's happening in Japan, okay? Whereas it's still going up in India and China. They're predicting that in the next, 15 years or so, we're going to crest and come down. So that you have a data issue, at least it's presented in the popular media, okay, whether this is still an issue. The second thing is, it's the nuance of the church teaching. The church teaching is that the couple decides what to do. I mean, they have to decide whether to have children or not. We're talking about means. So we think the artificial means are not to be used, but natural means can be used. So the population issues can be, like, for example, my friend Dr. Hannah Klaus, she has taught natural family planning in Tanya to people that can't read or write. So she said, you know, this is learnable behavior if people choose to act in a certain fashion. So it's not again, and the church teaching, and at least some of the theologians writing on this would say, and certainly population of your country or region or whatever, should be a consideration of, and we do not advocate people just having numerous children because they feel they have some obligation to do so. But how you go about that is the issue. Another thing which I didn't mention in the talk, of course, part of the debate, this is a roaring debate since 1968, okay? And it continues on, and it got resurrected because of the politics of healthcare, which has been going on now, and the politics of the election campaign, frankly. But in Catholic moral thinking, issues are linked. So in the popular media, it's this issue, this issue, this issue, like they're all separate. Part of the whole debate after Vatican II between the revisionists and the non-revisionists, and I obviously took a stand on this long ago, but also in this talk, that centered around moral systems. If you say you can justify contraception by results alone, why can't you justify other things, abortion, euthanasia, etc., based on results? Can you develop a moral system that maintains human dignity if you say in certain moral cases results are the prime determinant? And that was this huge debate. It gets into whether you want an Aristotelian model or a utilitarian, or what they call today, a consequentialist model. So that's another piece of this. It's part of a bigger picture of moral reasoning that we have adopted a moral overview, the Cardinal Bernardin talked, you know, about the connection of all the life issues. He put it in the seamless garment of life, he put it in a nice phrase, but it was not a new idea. And it's been part of Catholic thinking since like the second or third century, you know, to say, well, how does this all fit together in some coherent way? And that's also part of the underlying issue that would happen, you know. Anyhow, they're just points.
I'm wondering if you could comment on the influence of feminist theology and feminist ethics. And I ask that question because both the scientists and the theologians talked about a movement away from the self and self-centeredness and individualism and Cartesian dualism. And a movement toward communal practices, relationality, mutuality, embodiment. Margaret Farley would call those feminist ethics. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on that and which women authors you drew on from your research, if you did?
Related to this is the theology of communion of the Trinity that is popular. It's a communal basis. But part of that is the revival of not medieval, but patristic interest in relational things. So that goes back to the ancient church. And at Vatican II, it was in part a return to the sources and part a return to that way of thinking. In some ways, it doesn't reflect. I do think it reflects some feminist, or at least some feminine, concerns. Because feminist gets defined in all sorts of ways, you know. The different schools of thought, and so what I don't know. Yes, there is that part of the retrieval of that might be very well related to concerns about relational and so on and so forth. I think that it's at least is now people today don't want to necessarily pigeonhole people as being one way or another. Everybody's unique, and actually that's a question for us. All this is about in a genetics evolution big picture. We didn't get into personalist. What about the singular individual? That maybe is for another time. Authors, I drew on those three authors primarily. One of the footnote issues is from Celia Dean Drummond, who wrote on one of the issues of rape. She talked about, are animals moral? And that whole continuity in her essay in Zygon, December of 2009. And it's not explicit. You know, in my spiritual tradition, it's St. Jane de Chantal. Getting big emphasis these days among the Salesian, and when he writes book, Bond of Perfection and all. And that, for me, in some of my writing, that's one of the underlying things. Because to talk about Francis de Sales and Jane, their friendship with others, the relationships that are characteristic of Salesian spirituality. I mean, we got a whole, the book on friendship, my book on friendship, one of the reviewers said, this is Salesian underpinning here. Relationship, but it's not footnoted that often, but you know, so I'm kind of out of that model for sure.
Was that just for Dr. Cross? One thing I didn't mention in my talk this morning is where all these ideas came from, because as an ecologist, my primary interest was networks, essentially webs of who eats whom and by how much, and making mathematical calculations of when the system is in balance, out of balance, et cetera, et cetera. So I was invited to give a seminar up on our main campus once by a female colleague, and I gave my seminar, and mostly about networks and so forth. And when we were having lunch afterwards, she said to me, you know, that's a very feminist way of looking at things. You know? And I suddenly jerked. I mean, is something wrong with my masculinity or something like that? But what she was getting at is that it was primarily a relational thing rather than a single organism going ahead and doing its fate and so forth, which is most of what enlightenment thinking leads to. So that I think that this whole idea of both ecology and feminism, as we already know, there's a great deal of overlap. And it bears upon, I believe as well, evolutionary theory, as I've tried to argue today.
I wish to thank everyone here. It's been a great day.